Okay, Friday, January 13th, 2017.
Tesvav Teves.
Okay. So our halacha day of Perek Yud Ches. Over the course of halacha Yud Ches, we have Yisro showing up. So one issue one can look into is, honoring one's father, honoring one's in-laws. It's a little... work through that. I think we kind of did a lot of that when we talked about honoring one's grandparents last year. So, but the other thing that comes up is that Yisro sets up this entire system of justice. So, what exactly is going on with these multiple levels of people? Is it that they were a hierarchy that it went up, or is it that different people had one judge had a 10 group, and one guy had a 100 group, one guy had a 50 group. We just divided in that way. So the Sforno, at least, says something very interesting. He says, yeah, these were courts. And the Sforno in Perek Yud Ches, Pasuk Chaf Aleph, says, Ki amlam kishahayu dalin madregos zulam alamizu, that there are four levels, one on top of the other. Hine yishpur hakatan rishona, bat soek al psak dino yitzhak el hagadol himenu, that you first go and get judged by the lower court. And if you want to protest against that, if one is a tsoik, one's going to argue against that psak, so then he would go to the higher court. And then from the second to the third one, from the third one to the fourth one, and that way you would minimize the problems that were coming to Moshe Rabbeinu. And that's a very interesting idea. What the Sforno is suggesting is that Moshe was setting up a court system with a court of appeal, with an appeals process, which... Yeah. Like we have now in the secular world, right? Do we have it in the Jewish world? Yes, it does exist in Israel, in the Beis Din system in Israel, but it is very controversial that it does exist. Why? Because outside of the Sforno, there are not very many Makoros at all, if at all. There's nothing explicit in the Talmud that discusses the idea of having an appeals process. There is a suggestion of mistakes that were made by a dayan. In fact, the Gemara in the beginning of Sanhedrin talks about a dayan making mistakes and talks about whether a dayan will be held liable for damages if they make a mistake. But it doesn't go and say, oh, we're going to try the case again. Now, in a way, by definition, you are if you're going to say that he made a mistake. But you're not trying the case again between two litigants. You're trying the case between the loser of the first case and the dayan. It's a little bit different than an appeals process. So, talk about two. So let's talk about two aspects of this. One of them is the aspect in terms of iser v'heter, in terms of halacha, practical halacha, non-monetary law, and then we'll touch on the issue in monetary law as well. So there is a Gemara in Maseches Nida. The Gemara tells us in Daf Chaf Amud Beis tells a story of someone named Yalta. Yalta. Yalta, who was her, I forget who Yalta's husband was. Yeah, Rav Nachman. Yalta's husband was Rav Nachman, and Yalta had dam. She saw blood, and she wanted to know whether that makes her a nida, or whether that's going to extend her nida status. And in order to determine that, you have to bring it to the rabbi in order to figure out what this blood was. So Diyalsa Aisi Dama Lakami de Rabbi Bar Barchana. So Yalta brought the blood before Rabbi Bar Barchana. Now there is a side question here, that why didn't she bring it to her husband? So there's a few explanations to why she didn't bring it to her husband. Either the husband was colorblind, the husband was out of town, or something like that. Nobody suggests that it was prohibited to bring it to the husband, because the husband is nogeya b'davar, plus the husband, right? So that's very relevant. Meaning, can I paskin my wife's nida shailas, right? So it's learned out from this Gemara that from the Rishonim's explanation of that, that yes, that is okay. But for whatever reason, Yalta wasn't bringing it to her husband, so Yalta brought it to Rabbi Bar Barchana. So v'tamilei, and Rabbi Barchana said that this sample that you brought me is tamei. So l'kami de Rav Yitzchak b'rei de Rav Yehuda. So then she went to Rav Yitzchak. Like Rei Rav Yehuda, v'dachilei, and he said that it is tahor. Fine. So the Gemara asks, "Whoa, wait a second. That doesn't sound okay." V'heichi avid hachi. How could you do that, right? V'hasanya. The Brisa tells us, "Chacham shetimei, in chaveru rishai l'tahir." that once a chacham is metame something, you can't bring it to somebody else to be metaher. So it sounds like exactly what she did. So why was that okay? Barminan, so we say, timui havetamaye, that Rav Yitzchak had said that it was tame, but came into Amrale, but when Yalta told him, the chol yom marki le ki hai gavna ve in hu de chash beine, hadr dachile, that Rav Yitzchak, the second person, it said that it was a problem, but then Yalta says to Nero, but I always used to bring this to Rav Arachana, this exact looking blood, and he said that it was mutter. So that's why he said that it was tahor. But the Gemara, so Alma Mehemdale, so what does it sound? It sounds like we trust the woman. That's really what the Gemara is about, whether we trust the woman or not. So Gemara then rejects it. Rav Yitzchak Bar Yehuda Agmarei Samach. No, it's not true. Rav Yitzchak Bar Yehuda was relying on his own Mesorah. But you still have a problem. Wait a second. What about the first guy that she brought it to? What happened to that din? How does one resolve that? So the Tosfos raises that question, and Tosfos answers that the Kpeda lo havi ashoel el hachacham, that the Kpeda, the stringency of not, of once somebody asks something, is not on the person who asks. That person's allowed to go ask. Rather, the problem is on the person who answers. A person is not allowed to go against a psak that previously existed. So if somebody comes to me and says, you know, this rabbi said that this sample is tame, what do you think? Right? So then the problem is not on them. They're allowed to do that. The problem is on me. I'm not allowed to go ahead and pass against the previous letter. They could go ask whatever they want. And there are times when the first person makes a mistake and it will come to pass, meaning it will come to light that the person made a mistake. So if somebody tells this to me and says, you know, I brought it to Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Shmuel said this, what do you think? So I can't say to the person, oh, don't listen to Rabbi Shmuel, I'm going to. What I could do is I could call up what
the person who brings it is might not say.
So that's a problem. I mean, that they have to reveal that info, which Yalta did. Yalta did and tells him, oh, I brought it to the first guy, and he said it's a problem. So what do you think?
The same guy did possibly.
So in this case, he did. So why was he able to do that? So the assumption is that Rabbi Bar Bar Chana had wasn't well. He was getting older, and that's why he was allowed to. That's why he was allowed to override it. But in general, you have a problem. How was Yalta allowed to do it in the first place, right? The Rav Yitzchak said it was okay, but then they said Rabbi Bar Bar Chana would say it's tahor va'idnehu d'chash be'eni. But today he's suffering from an ailment in his eyes, and that's why he wasn't able to see it properly. So if there's a reason why that person might have made a mistake, the first person made a mistake, I'm allowed to rely on that. I say, oh, well, when did you show it to him? Oh, it was at night. Oh, it's at night now. It's the daytime. Maybe it's going to be different. Yeah. But in general, who is the Isser on? So Tosfos says the Isser is only on the rabbi. It's not on the person that's asking the question. The person asking the question, go ahead and do this. The
rabbi looks at a blood sample. How does rabbi know anything?
The tree.
How do I know about the blood sample? Or trained, yeah.
Trained.
The different blood looks different colors. Oh. And and it's not necessarily a sample of blood. It might be a sample of other things. It might be, sometimes the stain looks brownish. So, but there might be a speck of red in it. That these are details not for this year. But there is training that I went through in yeshiva to be able to pass in these shilas. Okay. So that's Tosfos 1. Tosfos, there is another Tosfos. Tosfos on that spot in Avodah Zarah, while dealing with a separate issue, asks this question. Well, what about Yalta? Why was Yalta able to go and ask another person? So the Tosfos there answers that the prohibition only exists if the questioner doesn't tell the second rabbi that there's a first rabbi who passed in the Chumrah already. Right? But they... Right, and then Tosfos then goes on and says, and if that's the case, there's a prohibition on the second Rav to paskin against the first Rav, unless I go ahead and convince the first rabbi that he made a mistake. So either Yalta's allowed to do it, there's no problem, there's no limitations on Yalta going and do it, or Yalta could do it, the second Tosfos says Yalta could do it, but they have to tell the second rabbi that that she made him, that I asked the rabbi already, and then the second rabbi has at his disposal to go back to the first rabbi and ask him the question. Just one more in detail on the laws, in these laws of showing samples. So there is, I remember Sobolovsky told me, somebody who I learned some of these halachos from, so he said that when women come to him with their samples, so he doesn't, the language is not tamei. You don't say, this is tamei. First of all, it sounds really bad to a woman. But it also, you've then established a psak on this sample. He'll say, I can't be matir this. I can't allow this. He's saying, I can't allow this. But if you want, Rabbi Neuberger lives a couple blocks down, you can go and ask him. I mean, that's what he's implying. So generally, they don't. But at least they have the ability to say,
yes.
What?
That's the guy who's in jail.
It's a poor choice of rabbi.
It's a bad choice.
Who's going back?
Want to kill his wife?
Yeah, who? Not this Rabbi Neuberger.
In Cherry Hill.
The one from Cherry Hill, his name was Neuberger? Oh, I didn't know that. Okay. I heard that story, but no, a different Rabbi Neuberger. It is the Orthodox.
He was Orthodox too.
No. The one who killed. No, it wasn't.
No?
Yeah, it was not an Orthodox Rabbi in Cherry Hill.
It's okay.
It's not okay, it's just. All right, so. So how do we paskin on this question? So there is the Ramah.
Before you go on, did you say the second rabbi has to talk to the first rabbi?
Yeah.
What if he passed away?
Well, this is one issue is that we're only talking about an actual sample.
Right.
Right. It's not about a din. We're going to get to that shortly. I mean, if they asked me that the person passed away, like within like that afternoon, right? So then you got a problem, I guess. But these questions are only about a sample, not about a halacha,
okay.
Right? And we'll get to that shortly. So the Rama paskins as follows: Chacham she'asar in chaver rishai lahatir mishikul hadas, aval im yesh lo kabbalah shata o shata b'davar mishna yochel lahatir. That you know, I'm not allowed to matir somebody else, but there's different ways of making a mistake, right? There's a mistake in where a person just doesn't know the halacha. And there's another mistake in where they made a mistake in terms of their judgment of the case, right? Not every question that comes up is you could just plug it in and find the book someplace. A rabbi has to make a judgment call often on, for example, there are some things that are mutter in order to be called the hefsid merubah, if it's going to cause a great loss. So who defines what a great loss is? So that's part of the job of the rabbi, to make an assessment about who's the one asking the question, what exactly is the monetary value of what's being asked, how easy is it for a replacement to get to be gotten, right? What qualifies as a hefsid merubah? So that's what we call, if the second rabbi disagrees in that issue, so that's a subjective issue. So that won't allow him to go and replace the first psak. He's only allowed to replace the first psak if he has either a tradition that I know how to, that this is my tradition on this specific halacha, or B, a person just made a mistake in what it says in Shulchan Aruch. A person made a mistake in what it says in the books. But if it's a judgment call, I mean, this rabbi said, no, we're going to be machmir, and I think, I can't be machmir, and this person isn't a wealthy person. All right, so then I'm not allowed to turn it around because that's what we call a judgment call. Continues the Raman, says, "V'afilu im ta b'shikul hadas." Even if you made a mistake in the judgment, yachol lisa v'litin im hamora ad she'achzibo. I'm allowed to go back to the first rabbi and talk to him about it until I can convince him to perhaps to change his mind. He has a right to change his mind. V'achein ein ister l'shor l'sheni. Therefore, there is no prohibition to ask a second rabbi. Uvilvad sheyodeya oso shekfar hora rishon lesser. As long as you tell him that I already asked this first rabbi, I'm coming for a second opinion. V'afiluim hitar rishon v'kfar chala horaso ein l'sheni lesser mikos shekaladas. And this also works the other way. If the first rabbi was matirit and the person can't believe it, they go to the second rabbi and say, he said it's allowed, what do you think? So even that is the same issue. Right, that is the same issue of doing the of not.
Are we still talking sample here, or now are we talking halacha?
Well, halacha slash sample. Meaning just as the Gemara was talking, the Gemara Nida gave the example. The Gemara Nida was talking about an example of a sample of blood. Right. But the same thing would apply to a pot of chicken soup that some milk might have poured into,
okay.
or kugel that the person used something that all of a sudden they realized later had an OUD on the bottle, right? So you're asking about a kugel. You're asking about the chicken soup. You're asking about the dump. But then he concludes and says, "V'chol zeh ba'osa hora atzma." That's with that psak. But if something else happens later on, meaning if now the person 2 weeks later milk falls into their chicken soup again, so they say, "I'm not going to that first rabbi. He was machmir. I'm going to go to the second rabbi who might be mekel." So that you're allowed to do, because you're not poskening on the same pot of soup. You're poskening on a halacha. So that is okay to do. So Rav Shechter has in his Sefer Ginos Egos, where is it? What? Oh, so how does that qualify? How does that go together with that a person should have one rabbi? Yeah. So that is considered a good etza for a person to have one rabbi, and perhaps there is a status of the rabbi who's the rabbi of the shul or the rabbi of the community. But there are, you know, the guy lives in Borough Park. And they daven in this place on Mondays, this place on Wednesdays, and you know that place on Shabbos, and when he wakes up early, and that place on Shabbos when he wakes up late. All right, so he doesn't necessarily have a rabbi. So you can go. So that's where these halachos are fitting in. We'll get to the Mor da'asra in a minute if we have time. So Rav Shechter has in his Sefer Ginos Egos, his third Sefer, you know that because it starts with the letter Gimel. First letter is Eretz Tzvi, second Sefer is Bikavei Atzon, third one is Ginos Egos. Halavai, you should get to the letter Taf. So in Siman Tes Zayin, he has an essay entitled "Bekashrus Dag Hatuna Shebikuf Saos," the kashrus of tuna fish in cans, and it's about does one need a hechsher on tuna fish, right? Do you? Right? Well, a lot of times we probably don't get a hechsher on tuna fish. Nowadays we do, because a lot of them just have the hechsherim. But back in the day, there was a shaila: do you really need to get a hechsher on tuna fish? And many
is cooked.
That's one issue. It's cooked. Okay. But it's not really cooked separately. It's cooked in the can. That's the way they cook the tuna fish. The tuna fish is first put into a can, and then it's steamed. So one issue is bishul akum. That is an issue. Is that then a problem of bishul akum, as you spoke about this week? Is steaming in general a problem of bishul akum? And when the steaming is done in Puerto Rico someplace where they catch the fish, is that old? And I have no idea who the guy is doing it. That right? That's an issue. And then the other issue is, how do I know that's actually tuna in the cans? It might be dolphin. It might be horse. I don't know. But that is a question. So how do I know that it's tuna in the can if I don't have a mishkiach there? No, because the FDA says that if you're going to sell something called tuna fish, there has to be tuna fish in the can of tuna fish. And you have to put up these various safeguards in order to ensure that it's not dolphin or catfish or whatever else might end up in there. So can one rely on that? So that's what the most of the essay is about. But the first thing he mentions is that it was in the 50s, it was paskened by Rav Henkin. Rav Henkin was a major posek in New York. I think he passed away in the 70s. A major posek in New York. His svarim were published, not so easy to get a hold of. They're actually being published now. So I actually have a sefer on Yerideya. He has several tshuvos on the matter, on the issue of tuna fish. And Rav Henkin is machmir. Making his machmir on this issue, he doesn't say that that it's permissible because there's no mashkiach there and all the reasons that you suggested. So Rav Shechter points out, so there are those that claim that one has no right to be makel on tuna fish nowadays.
Makel meaning
lenient.
You can
either use without a hechsher or what he might be referring to is that the OU will not have. Well, OU might put an OU on it, but what amount of hashkacha do they need on it, right? So that's the other part of it.
Like the OU hashkacha
on
water.
Right.
Water is one thing, but tuna, you have to cut it with a knife.
No, I understand.
I mean, there's so many. How can I not have a hechsher?
Because when they're collecting tuna fish, there's just tuna. I mean, that's what the rules are. I mean, you're really relying on the government supervision of it, similar to milk. Right? Milk, if you're not Makban Nechal of Yisrael, you're relying on the government supervision that it's cow milk and not pig milk.
But they can process crab meat in the same facility.
If they do, then that's a problem, but apparently they don't, those safeguards are set up to ensure that they don't do it. They do, but what level of hashkach are they relying on? So I believe there are I'm not an expert on tuna fish. I don't eat tuna fish. But I believe the Hemisha, quote unquote, Hemisha Hashkachas don't rely on the OU on tuna fish because of some of these reasons.
You don't need
no, that's why if you go to Borough Park, you'll find different brands, these the firm brands of tuna fish. Right? Anyways.
No, wait a minute. You're saying they don't rely on the OU because it has to have a hechsher, then OU is.
They'll say we're not going to allow any tuna fish unless there's a mashkiach there the entire time. Right? So, but anyways, the part relevant to us is that the very first little piece that he has here is there are some that claim that I'm not allowed to say that they're mutter because Rav Henkin Paskin in the 50s that tuna fish is usser unless it has the following things. So therefore, because chacham she'asser, once there's a chacham that assered it, another chacham is not allowed to come and say that it's okay. So Rav Shechter says right off the bat, he says, wait a second, that only has to do with the tuna fish in the 50s. Rav Henkin said, yeah, tuna fish under this hat that was made, that was watched in this way in the 50s is no good. But I hope that that tuna is no longer in existence anymore. Maybe that's in some fallout shelter someplace. But other than that, their assumption is that the tuna fish that we're giving a hechsher on in 2017 is going to be different, is going to be different fish than from 65 years ago, right? So that's answer number one. It says answer number two is that, yes, it's true that Rav Henkin might have been machmir during that era, but there are plenty of Rabbanim that were makil in that era as well, including Rav Yosef Soloveitchik and including Rav Aaron Kotler. So therefore I have the right to come ahead and give you my reasons for my various leniencies when it comes to tuna fish. Okay. So that's issue one. Issue two along these lines actually gets into the Rav Ha'ir issue. I saw an article recently, Rabbi Hoffman, I forget his first name. Hoffman writes a halachic piece every week for the Five Towns Jewish Times, and it gets spread all over the internet. So he wrote a piece about the famous incident that happened in Vilna. I want to collect a list of anonymous people whose actions led to big machlokasim in halacha. So the story goes on an Erev Shabbos, there was a poor tailor who collected enough money in order to buy his chicken. And his wife, they have the chicken shechted, and it's Erev Shabbos. And there's different versions of the story. One version of the story is the chicken itself was a Suffolk treifa, questionable whether it was treifa. Another version is that he was making chicken and some milk fell into the chicken or something. Those are the two versions. But either way, he has a shaila 2 hours before Shabbos, an hour before Shabbos, whether this chicken is mutter or not. So he sends his kid off to ask the Rav of the city, or he goes off to ask the Rav of the city, and the Rav of the city lives on the other, you know, 3 hours, 3 miles away. So he's going. Meanwhile, his wife is like, I need an answer. Two blocks away, the Vilna Gaon lives. Let me go ask the Vilna Gaon. So again, the details of what exactly, how this happened, transpired is unclear. But apparently someone went to the Vilna Gaon, the Vilna Gaon paskind usser, and the Rav Ha'ir paskind mutter. Yeah. Right? So what do we do now? So what do we do now? So they went back to the Rav Ha'ir, again, you know, now it's 20 minutes before Shabbos or something, and they tell him, you know, Yud Paskin was mutter, but the Vilna, you know, there is this person in town named Rav Eliyahu, they called me the Vilna Gaon, and he Paskin Asser. So what do we do about this situation? So the Rav said, you know, with all due respect to him, I'm the Rav of the city, I Paskin is mutter, it's mutter. And not only that, I'm going to come with the Vilna Gaon tonight, and we're going to eat your chicken together. Ooh. And so the story goes that the Rav goes to the house of the Vilna Gaon and says, I'm nothing but dust at your feet, but I am. They do pay me to be the rabbi of this city, and hence I Paskin the Shaila this way, and because I Paskin that way, therefore it's incumbent on, it's the psak for the city, and therefore I need you to come with me to the house, and you're going to eat the chicken with me. Ooh. So the Vilna Gaon said, of course. Yeah. Vilna Gaon said yes. Vilna Gaon was not the Rav of the city, right. He didn't really I'm surprised he even took this shot. I'm not sure how it worked. He didn't really take shilas. He didn't really deal with people. He was secluded in his room, and this is an unusual circumstance. So anyways, so they came and so the story goes that they came that night, the Rav and the Vilna. By the way, after the Vilna Gaon passed away, I don't believe there was another Rav of the city until maybe Rav Chaim Ozer. I'm not even sure if Chaim Ozer qualified as the Rav of the city, but for about 100 years, there was no Rav of the city after the Vilna Gaon passed away. But anyways, they come to the house, and they put out the plates in front of them, and at the last moment, the candle tipped over into the chicken, the candle was made from non-kosher fat. The wax was made from non-kosher food, and therefore the food was not edible anymore anyways. Right? So that's the story. How you deal with that end part is difficult. But anyways, that's the way the story goes. But you see that the Vilna Gaon was ready to succumb to the psak of the Rav Eir, because the Rav Eir does have that status. But again, not every place is like Wynwood, Pennsylvania. There are plenty of places that have multiple rabbanim and people don't necessarily have their self-appointed poskim. Okay, along these lines, it came across that...
Shmuel Kamensky...
I don't think he would ever claim himself to be the Rav of the city. But these kinds of issues do come up. If someone comes and asks him a question, they ask me, you know, like these you could see such a scenario playing out. Does the rabbi of a shul qualify as a Rav Ha'ir like it was in the past is subject to debate, and probably different people will accept it in different ways. Asra is a place. So the Mora, the teacher of the place, or the master of the place.
Like
so
you, a city.
Could be a city, could be a neighborhood, could be a defined area, yeah. So Rabbi Bleich, in Volume 4 of Contemporary Halachic Problems, he actually has a 30-page essay or so on the topic of an appeal, a Beis Din appeal. So he has, Chapter 1 is about Batei Dinim in general, about a Beis Din, an institution whose time has returned. And then section 2 in this book is the appeal process in Jewish legal system. It's about 35 pages. I didn't have a chance to go through the whole thing, but I did come across a very brief summary by Rabbi Chaim Jachter that he has in one of his pieces, where he points out that there is nothing in our... There are those that complain about having an appeals basin because it's somewhat of an acceptance of a foreign idea. We don't have... It came from the non-Jewish court system, this idea of having an appeal system. Now, you do have this foreigner saying, no, we came up with it first. But, okay, that's a pshat on a story in Chumash. It's not necessarily going to carry the real strong halachic weight. So there are those that objected, but there are those that participated, including those that have participated. And since the 20s, the tens and 20s or so, I mean, the Rabbi Bleich's history goes even further back, but since the time of Rav Kook, there was this Beis Din Court of Appeals. Amongst those that have sat on the Beis Din, on the Rabbanut Beis Din Court of Appeals, are Rav Yitzhak Herzog, the Tzitz Eliezer, Rav Avadi Yosef, Rav Yosef Shalom Eliyashiv, and Rav Zalman Lechem Goldberg. Right? So that's a pretty impressive array of people. Now, interesting, Rav Avadi Yosef and Rav Eliyashiv were both on the Beis Din for the Langer trial. Does the Langer case mean anything to anyone in this room? In the 70s.
Yeah, where the kid was...
But there was a... Yeah, there. Keep on chazering the details of the case. But there was a person who, a woman who supposedly had gotten married to a convert in Europe, came to Israel, never got a get from that convert, supposed convert, and then had more children in Israel. So those children apparently are mamzerim. So when it came for those kids' time for those kids to get married, so they said, wait a second, they're mamzerim. So Rav Gorin, who I believe these are the details, Rav Gorin, who was the chief rabbi of the time, paskin that they were mutter because the original gayrus was really no good. So the woman was never really married in the first place, so therefore her first marriage was to the second husband, and therefore these children. It was a very emotional thing because, these children had served in the IDF and things like that. It's a pretty big deal. So anyways, that court case was, I think, they were ruled mamzerim by a Beis Din. It went to an appeal. Who was on that appeal? That was Rav Eliyashiv, and I believe Rav Avadi Yosef as well. I believe they were both on that appeals Beis Din. They're both involved, and they both held that it was Aser. I believe after Rav Gorin overrode them, Rav Gorin was chief rabbi at the time, he overrode the Court of Appeals. That's when Rav Eliyashiv left the Rabbanut and said, okay, he quit on the spot. He resigned his post as being dying of the Rabbanut and went fully into the Haredi world. That's part of some of the history. So anyways... So Rav Avadi Yosef has a tshuva as to say why he thinks that it is okay
to do it. There is actually a Gemara that comments that that a beis din lo daiki, that a beis din should not look into the cases. Beis din does not challenge the rulings of another beis din. So Rav Adi Yosef says, they don't. That's regular practice, but it doesn't say that it's usher to do so. Right, so maybe you don't have a right to say that it's usser. Second of all, they prohibit only hearing the case from the beginning. But if you're not hearing the case from the beginning, you're just reading the arguments, then you have the right to argue on the arguments. Right? I'm not starting the whole court case again. I'm just seeing what the arguments were that the original Beis Din had put out. The third reason he thinks that it is permissible is that everybody knows that this is what's going to happen. This is the system. I mean, the problem is when you have a Beis Din that's assumed to be the final arbiter, and they make a psak, and then we go to another Beis Din and they offer a different psak. That's a problem. But if it's understood that we have a Beis Din that we're starting with, and you'll have a right of appeal following, so then he thinks that it is okay, And everybody knows that that's the way that it's set up, that the greatest rabbanim are on this appeal based in. Rabbi Jachter points out here in the conclusion that there are things that Rav Soloveitchik had this idea, that there are things that time sort of figures out the halacha, that ultimately the halacha just kind of resolves itself based on you see how Beis Din acts, and the fact that this appeals Beis Din has been going on for 100 years or so, almost 100 years, so that's probably a good enough reason to say that it's okay and we should and we could accept it. I believe the Beis Din of America, I remember hearing, does have an appeals process where after the psak is given by the Beis Din, you have the right to appeal to one Dayan Mumcha. So sometimes it will be sent on to one person to review the decision of the previous Bati Din. So this idea does seem, even though it's not found in the Gemara, does seem to have caught on in the contemporary Orthodox Torah Judaism. What? What do you mean, how is it determined?
Well, let's say there's something that new that comes on the scene, you know, and like the infertility thing and stuff like that.
We figure out what principles they are, and we...
Yeah, who determines? Let's say...
Who's the psak? So...
Somebody psaks one way, somebody does it the other. They're both very push of a...
So these things get worked out over time. For instance, electricity is really a whole series of shirim to get here. But like electricity came out. So what's the psak of electricity? What is it? And you hear stories in the 30s that there were rabbanim who used to turn lights on yontif and turn off, whether turn off, turn on, not turn off, right? But as time developed, it kind of worked itself out that there's an official psak on electricity. What about non-light electricity? So a lot of these things, they kind of get decided over the years and over the decades. You don't necessarily have to move so quickly. Sure. I mean, there's journals of some things yes, some things no, but there's entire journals of these kinds of issues being fought out. Okay, we'll stop here.
Thank you. Good job.
Oh, I never...